Hello and welcome to the Theology Mail podcast brought to you by Wipfenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickle. I'm on staff here at Wipfenstock and I'm the host of this podcast, which consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. So in this episode, I interview Dr. Sean J. McGraw on his 2023 Pickwick volume, Political Eschatology. Professor McGraw is professor of philosophy at Memorial University of Newfoundland and adjunct professor of religious studies at McGill University. He's published widely in the history of ideas and the philosophy of religion, especially on Heidegger, Schelling, and psychoanalysis, just to name a few. So with that, thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. All right, so I am here with Dr. Sean J. McGraw, author of the recent Pickwick book, Political Eschatology, and he's calling in from Newfoundland. So we were calling from coast to coast and between countries. So Professor McGraw, thank you very much for coming on the Theology Mail. As we kind of kick things off, could you just tell me a little bit about yourself, maybe what you do for work and maybe kind of your primary areas of research?
Well, thanks for having me, Zach. I'm happy to be here. I like the podcast very much. So I am a professor of philosophy by trade, and I have been doing that for about 20 years. So my recent appointment is at Memorial University of Newfoundland, but I also have an adjunct appointment in religious studies at McGill University in Montreal. But I'm really a theologian by calling. I've called myself a crypto theologian in the past, but I guess I've kind of come out of the closet lately. So I do teach theology when I can on occasion, and I do teach religious studies in Montreal on occasion. But continental philosophy is sort of my livelihood. So I'm 19th and 20th century German philosophy specialist. And so there's a lot of Schelling and Heidegger and that kind of Husserl, that kind of thing in my workday.
Wonderful. You wrote a dissertation on Heidegger, didn't you? And a monograph, right? At least one monograph.
My first book. Yeah, it was at the University of Toronto. I was at the U of T really just immersing myself in Neoplatonism because it was a very good place to do that kind of thing back in the 90s. And I was basically stepping right out of the Middle Ages in many ways. And I took a course in Heidegger, and I was so agitated by his treatment of the Middle Ages that I did a very dumb thing and wrote a dissertation that was critical of Heidegger. The reason it's not a dumb thing to be critical of Heidegger, but it's not a good idea to write a dissertation critical of a major figure, because think about it. Where, you know, when you write a dissertation, you're looking for a community to land in. So where do you land, right? So the Heideggerians didn't want me. And, I sort of ended up homeless. But the reason for that was that I was really quite committed to Thomas Aquinas and the Latin development of Neoplatonism. And I wanted to kick in, I wanted to offer something on that debate, which had already been a bit old. You know, there was Caputo and people like that had been writing on Heidegger and Aquinas. But I was coming in at a time when the early Freiburg lectures were being published in German for the first time. So the late 90s, they were coming into view because Heidegger insisted that they should not be published. And as some people know, most people who do Heidegger know, in these early lectures, Heidegger is transitioning from his apprenticeship as a philosopher of the Middle Ages or a scholar of medieval philosophy. He wrote his Habilitation Schrift on Scotus and Erfurt. He was transitioning from that to phenomenology and constructing the position that he would take on Christian theology, which he's most known for, namely the very critical position of Christian theology is essentially ontotheological. So I decided to try to weigh in on the old debate about Heidegger and Thomas Aquinas from the perspective of these early Freiburg lectures. And that was the that was the dissertation. That was my first book.
Lovely. No small task, I'm sure. Okay, so for our opener question, which I think some of our guests find very, very difficult, and some of our guests find very, very fun, and then I think some of our guests find it maybe a little bit of both. So opener question is, if you could place any three figures, they can be dead or alive, put them in a room together, and you could listen in on their conversation, which three figures would you choose and why?
Yeah, I know you were going to ask me this, so I've been thinking about it. It's an interesting question because some of the obvious candidates you really wouldn't want to just have in a conversation, you know, Jesus, for example. He's not a conversation partner for me. So I thought about this quite a bit, and I think I would pick Socrates, Paul, and Schelling. And I think I would pick Socrates and Paul because I think that the Greek and the Jewish voice, particularly as it comes to some kind of head in those two figures, the Greek and the Jew, the Greek and Jewish root. I'd like to hear them. I'd like to hear them have it out, so to speak. I mean, I think they would have a pretty interesting discussion because I think Paul was quite up to Socrates' dialectical tricks. And I think Socrates is far more open to Pauline revelations than your average professor of philosophy makes him out to be. Mm-hmm. And then the reason that Schelling's in the room is because he is, and to my mind, the modern thinker who has most recognized the, to use a Heidegger term, the equiprimordiality of the Greek and the Jewish root. And then the one is not reducible to the other. The two are opposites, but opposition is what makes something lively. So it's what makes the Western tradition lively. So I would have loved to have heard Schelling sorting out the dialectical tangles that Paul and Socrates get into my dinner conversation.
Sounds interesting. Sounds like a very dense dinner conversation for sure. Okay, so let's turn to your book. So in your preface, you write about eschatology's beginning in the negative, right? So you write, for instance, I'm going to quote just a short little passage here. You say, "My no is as much a no to what passes for conservatism today as it is a no to the quiet desperation of the left." And then you say, "That's a lot of naysaying, but eschatology must begin in the negative. Eschatology rejects the world as it happens to be." So how would you describe the nature of those two rejections you're talking about? You know, that of both today's conservatism of a certain stripe and of today's leftism of a certain stripe.
Right. I think they're both implicated in eschatology because, as you know from the book, I hold the whole Western tradition to be tangled up in eschatology, either unconsciously or consciously, in disavowal or not. So they're both kind of eschatologically determined positions, and they're not older than the age of revolution. People kind of forget that. They think that Thomas Aquinas was a conservative, but he couldn't possibly be a conservative. There were no conservatives before the French Revolution. So they're both positions about the future, with the left having a utopian vision of the future as something that could become much better than the present if we simply take back the power, so to speak, you know, in a Feuerbachian sense or Marxist sense, recognize that what we projected onto the heavens is really our own human potentiality. And once we reclaim it for ourselves, we'll unleash this political power to transform the world justly, to make it a just and to make it into the kingdom of heaven on earth, with the conservative also looking towards the future, but recognizing that the past is a story of sin and fall and moral corruption, and seeing really no possibility for the human being going forward. But what happens to these two views is that they become distortive of the eschatological origin. So the utopian model is, it gets the fundamental claim of eschatology dead right. And the fundamental claim of eschatology is that the future can be radically other than the past and the present, that we do stand before the new. And this future can actually be better than anything that has been before. So it gets that dead right. But by arrogating to itself, to the human, the political capacity to bring about the desired change, it turns the eschatological into the utopian. And this is where all of the horror comes from. This is why every revolution turns into some kind of betrayal of the values of the revolutionaries and the terror and so on. With respect to the conservative, I think that what happens there is also in a certain way bad faith, in as much as the pessimism of the conservative, which is sound, namely that there is nothing really to be expected from the human being alone. The human being alone is capable of nothing other than injustice and evil. The human being, that is, without grace. So it understands that correctly, but it tends to use this pessimism as a way of preserving the status quo, because usually it's in its own interest. It's no accident that great conservative thinkers have usually belonged to some kind of privileged class. So there's an interest in preserving something which is in our interest. And eschatology is going to tear the eschaton tears everything away. It tears all the things that we loved away, as well as all the things that we hated. So I find that both of these positions are inadequate. And so I have no home among conservatives or among progressives, really, because I'm an eschatological thinker.
So where would your home be, if not with conservatives or with liberals?
I think my home is in Christian political theology. I think Christianity is intrinsically political, which isn't to say that it's a political agenda, but it never holds itself aloof from the political, and it never really has. But it's never really found, it finds every political faction at any given moment to be inadequate to the revelation that is driving it into wakefulness or action on occasion. And so I don't find, for example, the early church, which inspires me quite a bit, the second century, the preconciliar churches, the pre-Nicene church, I don't find it to be, I find it to be politically ambiguous in a rich way. You think of, let's say, the house churches of Rome, obeying the law, paying their taxes, and you know, not abolishing things that obviously should probably be abolished, like slavery. So what would we call it? A kind of conservatism in a certain way, in as much as it's preserving this, it's not advocating radical, immediate political change, but at the same time, you know, refusing to worship the emperor as a god, and then willing to die for that. So we hear that story a lot, but we have to remember that the emperor, like Marcus Aurelius or someone, demanding that the Roman citizen recognize him as a god is a political move of securing the power, securing the stability of the empire. So my sense is that Marcus Aurelius, for example, has no delusions that he is a god, but he needs this monotheistic principle to maintain the order of the empire in an era in which paganism and polytheism has become decadent or even has fallen away altogether. So there's a kind of like, I will not serve act there that the early Christian performs, which you might want to associate with a more radical, progressive, or revolutionary position. But as you can see, it's neither revolutionary nor is it conservative. It's simply Christian.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so jumping topics a little bit, I want to talk about death of God theology, because you have some really rich discussion of that in your book, and especially in your preface, you have some really interesting stuff on that. So I'm going to quote again something you say. So you say you're talking about the death of God. I think this is from the preface. You write, "For your average graduate student today, the death of God is not an event at all. It is a non-event marked only by the theological ignorance of the ordinary post-Christian. So the theologian might see the cross in this forgetting of God, but the shopper does not. Most of the people I work with in philosophy suffer no anguish over the passing of the theological age. The death of God is only practically present for them as the total withering of Christendom, which they generally regard as a good thing. As a contemporary psychoanalyst put it, people don't want redemption or salvation. They have cell phones," which is a funny little quip. But you also, I mean, you also clarify there that it's not just an issue of indifference, right? But it's also perhaps even more so a question of ignorance. So you say, again, you say it is not that people are indifferent to redemption. They are wholly unconscious that there is such a thing at all. So I wonder if you might say more about this age of being kind of in a way post-God or post-death of God, but also how you think it might look for the unconscious that you're speaking about in your book to kind of be addressed or even reawakened in the world we live in today.
Right. So here's a little context. As this book was being put together at various moments, there are most of the book, well, no, I'd say about 60% of the book are essays that were published in a different context. I befriended Tom Altizer, who is one of the founding fathers of the Death of God movement. He was the one who made the cover of Time magazine in 1966, that black cover, is God mm-hmm. dead? Mm-hmm. And Tom Altizer became a close friend in his last years. I would meet him at conferences and we would correspond. I became one of a circle, not that small a circle, because he liked to keep in touch with a lot of people that he would regularly correspond with and share his thoughts and his work. And I really had not thought a lot of the whole death of God theology very much until I met Altizer. In fact, I kind of thought it was sort of silly in some respects. Mm-hmm. Either it meant something like something that is mainly manifestly not possible, that the eternal God should die, or it meant that we are actually happily modern, satisfied in a post-religious age and getting along just fine with technology and consumerism. But neither of those things seem to be correct. So I've never been really interested until I met Altizer and began to listen to him talk about this death of God as a theological event. He was a very interesting man, completely somewhat underrated figure. We know about his early work, but few people read his later work. And I actually met him at a conference at SPEP, actually the Society for Phenomenology and Existential Philosophy. I was giving a paper on the late Schelling's eschatological thinking, and he was in this crowd of people, and he piped up and he said, "Do I detect a theological voice?" And then we sat down and we began to talk, and we talked and talked, and then we talked more, and then we met again at other conferences, and he was a puzzle to me, because for him, the death of God was a theological event. He really meant it literally in a certain way, that God had really died, and this was not some kind of calamity, but it was actually what was expected, what was called for in a certain way, or what was prophesied. You know, that this was the fulfillment of the Christian reality, and the Christian theologians had to now reconcile, had to live in the death of God in a way that most people were not nearly ready to. And I couldn't figure out what he meant by this. He certainly didn't mean that now we live in indifference to Christianity or the gospel. There was nobody who was more interested in Christianity and the gospel than Tom Altizer. That wasn't the point at all. It was some kind of paradoxical neo-Hegelian gesture of you could say tarrying with the negative, or maintaining oneself in the recognition that this negativity was at the very heart of one's existence. And what got me was that this was theology. It was not a faithless gesture. So just a ton of paradoxes there for me. And finally, I realized that what Altizer was saying is that we need to affirm modernity without reservation as apocalypse, as revelation, as not only what ought to be, but what is and cannot be otherwise. And this was really what I meant about that in that preface in the passage you just read, when I say no to modernity. Now we move to the indifference of people to the theological problem, which is really as you used the word unconsciousness. That's an excellent word. This kind of lack of consciousness about what motivates them and why they shop, for example. As you know, later in the book, there's a chapter called The Theology of Consumerism, where I argue that consumerism is fed not by industrial production, and advertisement, creating needs that don't exist in order to maintain capitalist economy. But consumerism is fed by a theological eros that is so thoroughly repressed and in disavowal that it can manifest itself in this antichrist form. So that's not a death of God, is it? That is actually the repression of God, or if you want, the repression of the religious instinct. Hmm. I am, at the end of the day, still a believer in, you know, instinctual religiosity, or, you know, the desiderium naturale, if you like, of Thomas Aquinas, or as the reformers called it, notitia dei insitia. So the internal drive towards something like infinity, which is constitutive of human being, human consciousness. So that doesn't die, that never dies. And therefore, they're really, the death of God is really something completely overstated. It's either some kind of Hegelian Aufhebung, which I have no intention of participating in, wherein the human age becomes the legitimate successor of the theological age, or else it's misnaming our moment, which is a moment of theological repression rather than theological fulfillment or theological realization. And the last quote there that you read, we don't need redemption, we have cell phones, that was something that was communicated through correspondence from a contemporary Jungian analyst, Wolfgang Gigerich. I spent 5 years at the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich studying Jung and coming to know Gigerich. And Gigerich is probably the most important post-Jungian. He's certainly the only one to really advance the paradigm beyond Jung, and he doesn't have any of the defects of most Jungians. There's nothing woolly or half-baked or intellectually suspect about him. He's a very rigorous thinker. But what he's done is he's taken Hegel, or the Hegelian seeds of Jung, and he's really allowed them. He's developed them to the point where Jung himself has been left behind, and we have a new form of psychology. And the way he puts it is that he has an essay that's called The Death of God and the Birth of Man. This sums it all up. So accepting the death of God for Gigerich means recognizing that the human being is alone, and the human being now needs to affirm itself in its aloneness. It doesn't need divinity. It doesn't need redemption. It no longer craves another world. It no longer projects itself onto the heavens. It's kind of a full realization of itself. So definitely Hegelian, to some degree Nietzschean, kind of a death of God moment. And yeah, that's his quote. People don't need redemption. They have cell phones. And it's a funny thing to say in a certain way. And I agree with him that, you know, people do not consciously look for redemption because they have their cell phones. But where I would disagree is in the interpretation of what this means psychologically. Not that we are now at the age when we can realize imminently and on a human level everything that we previously projected onto a theological screen, but rather that our situation is one of such inversion of theology that something like the cell phone or shopping or travel can effectively substitute indefinitely even for the religious imaginary, for religious symbolism. It can feed those levels of need in us or appear to feed them. It really actually maintains the desire in a certain way. And that's absolutely fundamental to consumerism, is that it's insatiable. So failure and disappointment are no obstacle to the consumer age, because that's exactly what we want, right? It's the timed obsolescence of our consumer products is something that's necessary. If we were satisfied with our goods, we would stop shopping. So there's this intrinsic infinite telos in our preoccupations with technology and consumerism and new experiences. And it leaves us quite miserable, really, and almost confined to the surface in a way that creates, you know, widespread despair and mental illness and contagion of suicide, you know, among young people and that kind of thing. So I don't call that the death of God. I call that the repression of God, if you like.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so in a world like, you know, kind of what you're talking about, in which we have smartphones, in which we have super malls, you know, Amazon Prime, we have freeways, international travel. I mean, what does it look like in your mind, or what might it look like to kind of reawaken that repressed religious instinct that you're talking about? I know that's a massive question, but just maybe a first crack at it, what would you say?
So it will result in new collectivities. So it's not an individual affair. I think one of the things that consumerism does to us is it compounds the atomization of the liberal order. So everybody's, you know, alone with their playlist and their YouTube feed and their Amazon account. You know, we don't even listen to music together anymore. So we're completely alone. And this is a perfect situation in which to kind of exploit and abuse the infinite telos of the human heart. So when the eschatological faith is reawakened, when we unrepress our theological arrows, we will actually begin to form new collectives. And this, of course, is happening. This is what we call the church, really. And the church can take many different forms, but this is why it's so intrinsically political. So things get political when two or three gather together and decide to live otherwise than their contemporaries. And this is what happens. Inevitably, this is what happens when genuine eschatological faith is reawakened. So we see communities of resistance, but it's this quiet resistance that intrigues me. You know, the quiet resistance of the early Christians that you can rightly pass for conservative because it's really not making, firing off fireworks and making a big fuss and not calling us to the barricades, but just quietly going about defecting from the existing paradigms. So I'm thinking of things like voluntary poverty, which sounds like a medieval term, and it certainly is. It's a Franciscan term, but it actually has quite a bit of purchase in secular ecological communities. People might call it something else. They might call it minimalism or something like that. What it means is that we live beneath the level of affluence and comfort that is possible for us in this era, for various very positive reasons. You know, just as Francis always regarded poverty as a positive thing. You know, the story when they asked Francis, young Francis, who was probably doing something, you know, very strange, like rebuilding an old church or looking after sick people in Assisi. They said, Francis, when are you going to marry? And he said, I have a bride more beautiful than any woman in all the country, Lady Poverty. He describes her in these erotic terms, someone who has so captivated him that he could not possibly for a moment be seduced by any young woman of Assisi. Similarly, you know, the voluntary poverty which is appearing in these small micro communities of resistance is generally motivated positively. So, you know, one lives, for example, with less electricity because one likes the night sky, mm-hmm. for example, or one lives without an automobile because one enjoys walking to work or bicycling. Or one is perhaps interested in being part of the solution and ushering in a more ecological civilization by not participating in the consumption of fossil fuels. These are positive draws that are bringing communities into quiet defection from the existing paradigms. You know, there might be other examples. We could talk about, you know, more theologically as that this eschatological faith is what makes church communities really strong rather than mm-hmm. perfunctory performances of Sunday obligations or carrying out some tradition your parents gave you. What makes it different? What makes the difference when a church community or a community within the church, more like it, a small group of people within the church really begin to take it very seriously? This is the reawakening of the eschatological faith. They now have their faces turned towards the East. That is, they're awaiting a new order of existence, which is unimaginable to them, but which calls them to vigilance and to this restraint with regard to the present age.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so speaking of that eschatological faith that you're talking about, right? You have a really great part in your book where you talk about the first century Christians. You describe them in the book as an apocalyptic sect of Judaism, right? In the first century Roman Empire. So I wonder, you know, is there anything else you might say in terms of things that we can glean in our age today, as far as moving from kind of a posture of sort of like apocalyptic anxiety towards something that maybe resembles more so kind of what those first century Christians had with something more like eschatological hope. I wonder if you could maybe say more about things we might glean from them.
Sure. It's a big question, but let me just throw this out there. With regard to the relationship to humanity and to humanism, so we are in an anti-humanistic age where humanism has been rejected. Secular humanism is dead and sort of regarded as incoherent. And insofar as the term's used at all, it's usually used in the context of post or transhumanism. There are many people excited about the end of humanity, either through some kind of cybernetic AI human interface or through some kind of extinction that will lead to, you know, life 3.0, whatever, all this, or even just a kind of delectation in eschatological or apocalyptic nihilism. You know, Ray Brassier, Nihil Unbound, you know, he gets excited about thinking about the aeons of time in which humanity will not even be a memory. There'll be nobody to remember it. I think that this is a problem. I think that humanism, however misused it was in secularism 1.0, which is happily behind us, humanism has to remain at the center of the Christian revelation, because the image of God, the invisible image of God, the image of the invisible God has the form of a human being. And so the human is, the revelation is in some way a revelation of what humanity really is, ought to be, could have been, will be, is in Christ, will be in the future. So I take this to mean that the Christian does not have the luxury of despair in the sense of anticipating a future without us. The Christian has to think a future in which the human flourishes. And this is extremely challenging, particularly for people who are, you know, paying attention to ecology and other trends. There's every reason to imagine that the human will be extinct in the next century. But there is no justification for the Christian indulging in that thought. The promise is humanity flourishing until the Christ returns. And so that is the, if you like, the theological virtue of hope. And it's not optimistic at all, because we are not anticipating, let's say, humanity as we know it, continuing indefinitely into the future. Sometimes I'll go so far as to say that we are not yet human. And in the Christ, we see the fullness of the human, which will be in the future. So humanity is an open project still in a certain way. And the fullness of humanity has still not occurred. So we anticipate the human rather than arrogate mm-hmm. or claim it to be our own. Mm-hmm. And that is a difficult thought. So some of the people who have inspired me in this regard are New Testament scholars. N.T. Wright, for example, who has really persuaded me and many other people that a subtle misconception entered into theology into popular piety in modernity, wherein we began to think that our home was somewhere else in heaven. And Wright, knowing his Bible as well as he does, knows that heaven is not our home. You know, even if Thomas Aquinas says, you know, our bodiless souls will be maintained in heaven until the resurrection, and the point is that this is not where we belong. We belong on the earth, an earth transformed. So a new earth, a new heaven, a new earth, as we read in 2 Peter and in Revelation. Mm-hmm. So we anticipate then a transformed earth community as well, because there's no such thing as a human without an environment. So the human and its body includes the whole cosmos, certainly the whole of the earthly nature, right? All of the animals and the plants and the pleroma of existence. That is why I think that the ecological is of such intrinsic importance to eschatological thinking. And in this regard, I really am taking on conservatives who reacting to the arbitrary fusion of environmentalism with other leftist projects, reject it. Because to be an environmentalist is to be, for example, pro-choice, or to be an environmentalist is to be some kind of utopian humanist or something like this. And so we have this strong conservative anti-environmental discourse, which I'm pushing hard back against. I think that ecology could be, or perhaps ought to be, the new natural theology for Christianity. And we should take a deep interest in the situation of the earth. Even if climate change is contestable, which it certainly is, the anthropogenic climate change is a scientific theory, it could be contested. Even if you want to say that is some kind of agenda constructed by some kind of cabal of leftists in order to deprive us of the our American way of life or something. What about ocean plastic? You know, that's not a theory. Mm-hmm. What about the disappearance of wilderness? You know, I just came back from an environmental event in Costa Rica. Costa Rica, which is, you know, the poster child of conservationism and environmentalism, especially since the 70s, when they took this very strong kind of national stand towards conserving to this day 25% of their country, which is, you know, an important figure. Canada, for example, is, I think, less than 2% protected. But in those 50 years, 94% of the wildlife has disappeared in Costa Rica. What's happened actually is that these national parks have become sort of havens for poaching. There's a large black market for the animals that can be poached from the either killed or taken alive out of the rainforest. So this massive destruction of wildlife, of all the diversity of creatures. Why would we be indifferent to this? You know, why would we be indifferent to any of the injustices with which our earthly existence is bound up? Not to say that we now need to become, you know, utopians and arrogate to ourselves the power to transform the earth in the ways that are promised to us. But we need to be vigilant. We need to, you know, pay attention and walk circumspectly, as the author of the letter to Barnabas puts it, looking always for signs of what is to come among the wreckage of the age and the time that's running down. And I think that the environmental crisis is exactly a place where we ought to look. So, I mean, those are just a couple thoughts on a very good question. But.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, you're mentioning ecology, and when we bring up, you know, ecology or the natural world, there are just so many, such varied kind of conceptions of it, depending on which thinker you're looking at, or what sort of school of thought, or what discipline, what epoch you're looking at, right? So many ways that it's kind of been conceived of. Right. So you have, like, for instance, you talk about in your book, like, the nature culture split as one way to conceive of it, right? Or kind of the nature as it's thought of in kind of scientific discourse. You have, you know, in the ancient world, you know, the idea of the cosmos, right? And interdependence. So I wonder, kind of in this eschatological key that you're writing in, what would it mean? What would it mean to think the natural world eschatologically, as you're kind of proposing in your book?
So the new earth is this earth transformed. That's how the early Christians understood it. So it's not as though we should celebrate the destruction of everything here, either through ecological violence or through nuclear Armageddon. You know, some Zionists in the U.S. are anticipating with glee, you know, an all-out nuclear war, so that we can sort of clean the slate and create the space for the new earth. The new earth is this earth transformed. I think the most vivid image of that that I've ever experienced, and it was almost a conversion moment for me, was in the catacombs in Rome. Like many people, I thought the catacombs were places where the Christians went to hide in persecution. And that's certainly where they did hide in the sporadic persecutions that occurred in the first centuries of the church. But that's not why the catacombs were there. The catacombs were there because the volcanic rock under Rome is so easily carved. You know, you can carve it easily. You can carve it with a spoon. And so it was a perfect place to create a Christian cemetery. And a Christian cemetery had a special requirement. It had to be constructed in such a way that the dead could get up from their graves and walk out the door into the earth transformed, this earth, this matter, with a new form. So I take that to be a kind of paradoxical gesture of, on the one hand, saying nothing is as it should be and everything will be changed. And at the same time, what will come will be the perfection of the world as we know it. So, you know, the world is obviously not just evil. That's why the Gnostic temptation was so strong in the early church and still is, because Christianity shares with Gnosticism this very strong doctrine of evil. That is not just moral evil, but also natural evil, that, you know, the material existence is not simply good, cannot simply be affirmed, you know, as the Epicureans would want you to do so, or the Stoics. We have to recognize that that there are many things about material existence which are not what they ought to be. Our own intrinsic sense for justice revolts at it, revolts at death and illness and even the material conditions of existence of one animal living off of the death of another. These kinds of things are not what ought to be. Even if we don't know what ought to be, we know that this is not the best that could be. But at the same time, the Gnostics went way too far and created this great cosmology of this idiot demiurge botching creation and trapping our souls and bodies. And obviously that's not the way to go. Irenaeus has to come along and say, no, 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 the body itself is good. That is why Jesus ascends bodily, you know, and all of these Orthodox Christian dogmas from Eucharist to the Immaculate Conception, they're all ways of affirming at least the potential goodness of the body, if not the actual goodness of the body. So we have this eschatological, paradoxical attitude of, on the one hand, condemning as unjust and at the same time affirming as good. That is, there are seeds of the new earth growing now around us. And we first of all, are not able to simply identify them with certainty, but with the eyes of faith, you know, with the gift of wisdom, the Jewish wisdom, which comes as a gift from God, not a human virtue, we may be able to discern the goodness. And we can be sure of one thing, that this new earth will leave nothing that we love dead. So it will be everything that we ever loved of the earth, insofar as our love was chaste and holy, will be recapitulated in Irenaeus' term. It will be recapitulated and transformed at the same time, as Christ's own body was unrecognizable. So there, this I take to be a kind of, in our age, this can become, as I say, ecology as a natural theology, a way in which we properly recognize the holiness, the sanctity of the essential features of the material order, that the, you know, Kuza, for example, would say that the whole of the universe is the image of divinity. The whole of the spatial temporal universe images the actual infinity of God, and there is no other image. It's not a spinozistic situation where we imagine, oh, there's an infinity of other possible worlds that are imaging God. No, this is it. This is the world. God looking at himself, seeing himself in the universe as the reflection of himself. And so, and that good Christian Neoplatonist, of course, knows this. You know, you think of Maximus the Confessor and the Logoi, you know, of every not just every species, but every individual in some way expressive of the divine mind in a direct way, revelatory of the divine mind. That seems to me in our age to become grounds for an ecological natural theology. Mm-hmm. And if we were to move towards that, I think our theology would have immense apologetic force. And by apology, I mean apology in the ancient sense of the word. You know, we would be able to give a compelling account of the things we hope for in terms that other people would immediately recognize as consonant with their own values. I find a lot of implicit religiosity in the environmental circles in which I move. Lots of aversion to Christianity, for sure. Lots of anti-humanism, lots of rejection of the Western anthropocentric attitude, and so on and so on. But still, a kind of reverence. I see this often in scientists, actually, who are insistent that they are atheists and materialists and nominalists. And yet, you know, the Eagle Nebula, that star nursery that was photographed by the Hubble telescope, fills them with something that can only be described as religious awe. They stand in it, they're entirely enraptured by the sublimity of the natural universe.
Yeah, sure. Okay. You know, this eschatological attitude that you're speaking about and that you write about in your book, you know, you mentioned earlier the Christ as sort of kind of figure of eschatological humanity, right? Kind of almost like a fulfillment of the human project. But I'm wondering if there are other thinkers that you can think of or who in your mind maybe kind of represent well this eschatological attitude or this kind of eschatological posture that you are kind of pushing for in your book. And then maybe what about them is kind of consistent with the sort of eschatological ways of thinking and living?
Well, the first point is that eschatology has always been a threat to the church. And for this reason, we find it particularly underdeveloped in Orthodoxy, and I mean in Catholicism and in Eastern Orthodoxy. And it gets more energy in Protestantism because the Protestants are much more comfortable with the idea of a transitional church. Because among the things that shall be wiped away will be the present form of the church, transformed, but in some way that we who belong to it would perhaps not recognize it, as Mary couldn't recognize Jesus in the garden on the first Easter Sunday. So it's a problem because it invites all kinds of heresy. You know, think of one of the first heresies, Montanism, based directly on the Gospel of John, the farewell discourses, the doctrine of the Paraclete, that the Spirit will come and we will do greater things than Jesus. It is written there in the Gospel of John. And Montanus says, well, the age of the Spirit is now here. And so the older forms of the church are now invalid and no longer binding on us. And we now, the age of the prophetesses and the prophets, we replace the older forms of the church. And this is obviously so vulnerable to abuse. And there's so much abuse of eschatology right into the present day that one can only recognize why the church is so wisely hesitant with eschatological discourse. That said, I'll speak about Catholicism because I know it best. The church will never close the door on it. And I don't mean obviously eschatology as the doctrine of the last things and a part of theology. It's not what I'm talking about, actually. I'm talking about eschatology as a comportment of the Christian, as the comportment of the Christian towards the present age. The enthusiasm, you might want to put it in those terms, if you wanted to speak in the ancient terms. It never closes the door on it. It always recognizes that at any moment, the Spirit might burst the bounds of what it regards as pious. And the places where I see eschatological faith are in the lives of the saints, and not only the canonical saints, certainly the canonical saints, St. Francis of Assisi, for example, or St. Ignatius of Loyola. Both of them, for me, have this, embody the paradoxical attitude of the eschatologist or the eschatological Christian, which says, nothing depends upon me, because I'm completely inadequate to what is promised. Everything depends upon me because I am the means that God has chosen to bring about his end, right? Or as Ignatius puts it, you know, you act as if everything depends on you. You pray as if everything depends on God. That is the paradoxical quality. And so you see in figures like Francis or Ignatius, you see this indefeatable quality that no amount of failure will quench their fire, their zeal. They cannot be discouraged because they never depended upon, they never expected to be the means. And so a kind of divine folly is manifest in these lives. They become somewhat ridiculous. They become somewhat absurd figures. I think my example from the life of Francis that most exemplifies this is when Francis hears the revelation in the Church of Assisi and the Christ saying, build my church. And he thinks he means go down the street and rebuild the ruined chapel at the end of the road, you know, in Assisi mm-hmm. that's full of gorgeous churches. And he just says, well, I that's what I'll do. And starts mm-hmm. piling stones upon stones, like an absurd figure, like a clown. and he is absurd because the Christ is asking him to rebuild the whole church, not build the little ruined chapel. But there are other figures too, like Simone Weil. You know, she really embodied this in her kind of a reckless willingness to go wherever she believed the Lord was calling her, even if she was completely useless in that context. So she went off and volunteered in the Spanish Civil War. And according to the biographers, she was more dangerous to the her patriots than a help because she was so mechanically inept. You know, mm-hmm. she was actually a danger to herself. So it's been called, you know, Weil's politics of the absurd. But the politics of absurdity is very eschatological. But on a more sober note, I see it, for example, in the life of Bonhoeffer, particularly in the way he died and the way he went to his death, without for a moment succumbing to the despair that his Nazi captors so much wanted him to succumb to, and emboldening those around him right until the very end. You know, for all he knew, it was over, and the Germany that he was trying to protect was doomed. Either it would become a Nazi regime at perpetuum, or be raised to the ground by the defeat of the Nazis. And yet he didn't for a moment think that he had made a mistake in going back. He didn't for a moment think that his life was wasted. So these are the figures that inspire me. Some thinkers, of course, I mean, there's eschatological thought is characteristic of late 20th century, probably most of the 20th century, when you think of Being and Time, you know, as the one of the masterpiece of eschatological psychology in 1927. And then, you know, the great Protestant, well, after Bultmann, the great Protestant eschatological awakening with people like Moltmann and Pannenberg. So these thinkers have been an immense influence on me. Their lives are not so important. They are thinkers, but the lives of the saints. Oh, and one last point too, on the Catholic Church, I've always loved the process of canonization. You know, those who are outside the church think the canonization process is just the popes going around crowning those whose Catholicism confirms their own particular spin on it. But mm-hmm. the canonization process is designed in such a way to kind of prevent that kind of abuse. It doesn't always work, but when it really works, the process is a kind of performative acknowledgement of the magisterium that the Holy Spirit operates independently of the magisterium. So how does that work? So the church is commissioned to listen, or the magisterium, to have some kind of uproar or some kind of hubbub in the people where sanctity has erupted among them. So there can't be a saint without a kind of reception of the people. That's the sign of sanctity. And then they look for the confirmations, the miracles, and so on. But the point is, the magisterium is in the position of recognizing the activity of the Spirit, not directing it. I take that to be a kind of eschatological structure in the canonical structure, you could say.
One thing we haven't talked about yet that I think is really important for us to go over in this conversation, because it's such a central feature of your book, and is this topic of contemplation, which also for our listeners, Professor McGraw has a podcast of his own where he deals with contemplation at some length. So be sure to check the show notes, because I'll leave a link there for his podcast where he talks about contemplation quite a bit. But yeah, so contemplation. I'm wondering what you might say as far as what role you think something like contemplation might play in kind of countering some of the problems that some of the kind of problematic effects that we're dealing with, or that we've ended up in modernity, particularly in an age that's sort of hardwired against kind of contemplative form of life.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. It's an excellent question. When we talk about contemplation, we really are dealing with the Greek heritage, right? The contemplative practice precedes the New Testament, and it really enters into the history of Christianity from the Greek heritage. So we think of the Plato in a school, or Pythagoras, or even Aristotle's understanding of the highest virtues. So the contemplative attitude is Greek, which isn't to say it's not Christian. So one of the things I've really come to in the last decade or so is to recognize that the Greek and Jewish root of Christianity, they cannot be torn apart from each other. There's no, you know, you can't. Bede Griffith, you know, went to India and started dressing like a sannyasin, and he was a Benedictine monk, and he said, "Why can't we just have the Upanishads and the Vedas as our kind of philosophical, natural theological frame for the New Testament?" So there's nothing particularly important about the Greek reception. And I think you can see how badly that failed in a certain way. So this Greek root, in another book I call it the Greek mind of the West, is intrinsically part of the Christian story. So you could say that God chose a Greek reception for his Jewish revelation, and it was not arbitrary. And so we get this contemplative stream. The eschatological is definitely Jewish. It's Second Temple Judaism. It's not even original with Paul. He was hardly the only one speaking in terms of a great cosmic battle of good and evil, which somehow mobilized us in this theological way. But the contemplative, not to say that it's absent in the Jewish, but it's very strong in the Greek. And it is a kind of holy passivity, of course. It's letting be, as Heidegger would call it, although he was just being a good interpreter of the tradition, Gelassenheit, you know, ceasing to pretend that you are so important, or that your activity persists in some kind of vacuum, but recognizing that there is a cosmos of meaning which has nothing to do with you, and which is radiant with beauty and goodness and truth, and which feeds your soul and gives you the energy you need to do the work that God asks you to do. So that is the contemplative. And I have a background in this. I spent some years in a contemplative religious order, and I was somewhat trained in, you know, mystical medieval Christianity. And so I'm unwilling to let this go in spite of some of the problems with it. There are problems, of course. Everything human can be turned into its opposite, and contemplation, when its problem is quietism, passivity, you know, becoming somewhat indifferent to the political, because, you know, the political just becomes part of this great show of being you let it go on without you. So there's an issue there, because I don't think Christianity is ever quietistic. So the contemplative attitude is qualified by the Christian eschatological attitude, and the two together become extremely potent. And what the contemplative does for the eschatologist is it tells him to slow down and walk circumspectly, as Barnabas puts it. That is, pay attention to what's happening around you, because you do not know what seeds are planted in the present, which will grow into the kingdom to come. Mm-hmm. So you have to practice this attitude of letting be, of refining your capacities for your aesthetic capacities, your intellectual capacities. The contemplative, I think, is intrinsically bound up with intellectual virtues, my great teacher in contemplative Christianity said, the beginning of a contemplative life is a solid intellectual life. And far too few Christians have one. So reading, thinking, even developing a capacity for speculation and philosophy, these are not necessarily contemplation, but they prepare the ground for it. Mm-hmm. Now, you asked about the cultural issue, and you're quite right that the culture is dead set against the contemplative in a certain way. And here, I think Heidegger was spot on in his critique of technology. The antidote to the technological enframing, which has imperiled the human essence, according to Heidegger, is reactualizing this medieval virtue of Gelassenheit, the Eckhartian word, to let be. What technology does is it refuses to let anything be, but always sets the terms for the showing of anything. So we shall have salmon all year round, not when the salmon run. And then, of course, the great revelation of beauty, which is the wild run of the salmon, is gone forever, disappears. And example after example. So this contemplative attitude is an antidote to the doing and to the hyperactivism mm-hmm. of technology. But it can't simply be quite passive. It has to recognize the possibility of quietism. So we speak then of an active passivity, sort of a kind of the, you know, and here we can go back to Paul and speak about the, you know, the vigilance that he enjoins upon the Thessalonians, just to wait, because the Lord will come in like a thief in the night. So this attitude of readiness, which is not activity, not passivity, but is the genuine attitude of the Christian contemplative. And you can see this all throughout the tradition. You can see it in Eckhart. You can see it in the great teachers of contemplation, Bernard of Clairvaux. It's always there. The contemplative is not a quietist, has not renounced activity, has not defected from the political, quite the contrary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that leads us nicely into some of these more political kind of streams in the book, right? So let's turn to a couple of questions that maybe deal with that a little more directly. So you talk about kind of two poles or two different streams, maybe we could say. So you talk about kind of, you know, Hegelianism and Schlingianism, right, as two kind of tracks. So what would you say are kind of the significant or kind of the signature differences between, I think in one place you describe it as kind of a deflated Hegelianism, which could be associated with thinkers like Zizek and Bajou, who are so wildly popular today. So kind of that on the one hand, and then representing maybe the other stream, this kind of eschatological philosophy of history that you're proposing and in some way drawing from Schelling, which maybe could be advanced as an alternative to certain kinds of Hegelian options. So whether that looks like Zizek and Bajou, like I mentioned already, or if it looks more like Kochev and Fukuyama and the whole end of history question. So I wonder what you might say are kind of some of the important differences between these two.
Yeah. So the first point there is that Hegelianism has pretty much won the day, certainly up until now. Maybe a new day is dawning for the philosophy of history, but where philosophers have talked about history, they have in one way or another lapsed into Hegelianism, even when they had no intention of doing so. Mm-hmm. So even someone like Max Weber, who for me is so important, and I consider myself some kind of Weberian, he becomes Hegelian when he speaks of the disenchantment of the world as a kind of necessity, as something that had to be and couldn't have been otherwise. And that is the Hegelian philosophy of history. So it's not to deny contingency, of course, but it's to speak of the necessity of contingency, that these contingent moments, these apparent contingencies of history, are the are the matter of the historical form, which comes to be, which is of the historical form that cannot be other than it is. So you get the idea then that there could only be one form of modernity. Carl Levitt, for example, with his critique of eschatology and meaning in history, ends up becoming Hegelian in a kind of dejected way. in recognizing that the Christian eschatology becomes the myth of progress, which becomes disenchanted, and then we have progress into nothing and we all become nihilists. And then somehow saying this can't be otherwise. This note of necessity, or rendering things that are genuinely contingent necessary. Not that we can reverse history. That's the folly of re-enchantment. I'm not at all interested in that. But in recognizing that there was other possibilities for being modern, let's say, if we talk about our age, which were not actualized, and which might be actualizable still, surely differently than they could have been actualized, let's say, in the Renaissance. But there, one could be modern otherwise. And this is what Schelling really brings to the table, because for Schelling, the future is really unknown. Even if we have certain promises and can prophetically look towards it on the basis of these promises, we have no means of deducing what will be. And when the future arrives, we deal with a positivity which is unprethinkable. Time for Schelling is unprethinkable. It's always a disruption of the pre-thought. So it's a disruption of the a priori. This is Schelling's, transcendental empiricism, that we learn what is real by having our a priori expectations frustrated, if not violated. And there's interesting connections between that thought, that way of thinking, and a proper understanding of scientific methodology. I think actually it is essentially scientific. This is what Peirce said. He found Schelling to be the most scientific of thinkers, because if you think about a scientific work, a scientific experiment, it sets up certain conditions, not to confirm necessarily what is expected, but to set up the conditions for frustrating the expectation, for producing the fact that refuses to be explained by the existing paradigm. That's what makes science move. So applied to a philosophy of history, we have a Schellingian philosophy of history when we recognize the irreversibility of time, you know, the non-cyclical nature of time, the revelatory or quality of time, or the eventfulness of time. And at the same time, recognize the contingency of time, that there is no necessity binding time in one direction or another, and that what occurs is always, in some respects, a surprise. So I'm not sure if that gets directly to what you're looking for. I'm happy to go more deeply into it. Schelling is a difficult thinker, and it's always hard to sum up the point succinctly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's very helpful. And yeah, I think we can definitely dig in deeper. Schelling obviously is a very difficult thinker. And for me, your book was sort of an introduction to his philosophy of history, which I just found so fascinating and rich in your presentation of it. And what I think one of the things that was most fascinating to me was kind of your use of his delineation of kind of stages or ages of the church, right? So you talk about this kind of Schellingian tripartite structure of the history of the church, right? So first we have kind of the Petrine Church, which we could maybe associate with, you know, the Catholic Church, then the Pauline Church, which we could maybe associate with, you know, Protestant churches, and then finally this kind of age of the Joannine Church, which I'll let you maybe explain more about. But I'm wondering if maybe you could share more about what Schelling means with this kind of tripartite philosophy of history, and then maybe more specifically kind of how you make use in your book of that third and final stage, right? The Church of John, or what you in some places will call like Schellingian Christianity or religious secularism even. I think, yeah, really nuts and bolts. Kind of my question is what resources would Schelling's notion of this Joannine church offer for the kind of age we live in which things like liberalism and consumerism and climate abuse have kind of continue to interlock with such problematic effects?
Right. Let's see what I can do with that. That's pretty tolerable. Yeah. So first, there was just one little leftover from the previous exchange. I think the whole point of Schillingian eschatological philosophy of history is to always cede the agency to God. God is the agent of history. History is God's drama, not ours, and we are side players in it. And that's the absolute reversal of Hegel. You know, so for Hegel, history is the history of humanity, realizing that it is the adequate and fulfilled expression of the spirit. And for Schelling, history is the history of God, and God has deigned to include us in his history, to make us even an essential moment in it. But it's not, at the end, it's not our history. It's not our story. It's not our individuation. It's his, and it includes us. So that's because when we begin to start calling contingencies necessary, what we do thereby is we rob them of their disruptive quality. We say, actually, we understand now how they conform to what we expect, what we think. And thereby, we say that history really is, in some respects, rational on human terms. But if there's any reasonableness to history, it is the revelation of the unfathomable mind of the divine. And we always remain learners with respect to it. So we're always kind of surprised by history. Now, with regard to the three ages of the church, that obviously is, in some respects, the least original part of Schelling's late work. That's Joachim of Fiore's Trinitarian interpretation of history, which Schelling says he only discovered after the fact, which I've always found to be somewhat suspicious. Schelling was an extremely well-read man. He was a scholar of Hebrew, Greek, Latin, certainly knew his way around all the church fathers. And apparently he only found out about Joachim of Fiore's Trinitarian philosophy of history after he had mysteriously constructed it independently. So I'm not sure what to make of that, because it's exactly Fiore's view. And Fiore, one of these dangerous eschatological thinkers, condemned in some respects by the Fourth Lateran Council, and caught up with, you know, some of the worst excesses of modernism, because the age of the spirit, the age of the prophets, makes the current age of the church obsolete, irrelevant, even wrong. So it's a kind of delegitimizing moment. Schelling's a little milder on it than Fiore is. But even Fiore, I think there's a way of rehabilitating him, although let's leave him aside for a moment. Schelling says he didn't read him. We'll take his word on that, just for the sake of looking what Schelling says. And Schelling's gesture was really an ecumenical gesture, first of all, of recognizing the equal legitimacy of the Petrine and the Pauline, or the Catholic and the Protestant moment of history. And by saying that the Catholic moment, the Petrine Church, is the church of the past, one has to realize that for Schelling, this means something quite different than what it would mean for Hegel. When Hegel says, you know, art is in the past, he means it's over. He means it has been negated and aufgehoben, that is, canceled and preserved, which for Hegel means we have a new we have a new way of doing what art previously did, which renders art no longer necessary. Schelling never means that by the past. By the past, Schelling always means the ground. So potency for Schelling is what supports actuality. That is the fundamental metaphysics of the late Schelling. The actual is supported by the potential. And the potential is always, in a certain way, unrestricted, in the sense that it's not determined by the actual. Properly speaking, it's the possible, which can become the potential for a certain kind of actuality. So when the Catholic moment retreats into the ground, we should rather think that it now supports the present, which is the Protestant moment. We are in the Pauline Church. So it supports the present. It remains, you could say, even more real in modernity than it was in the Middle Ages, because it has now become the foundation of modernity. So there's a strong argument here then for the theological lineage of modernity. The Pauline moment is the moment of internalizing the revelation. So if in the Petrine moment you had this external revelation as an external rule, binding together a great diversity of humanity, in the Pauline moment, there's a kind of rebellion of the human spirit against the legal structure, the legal structures of Catholicism, and a claim for the individual to be himself, herself, the recipient of revelation. And so Protestantism properly reclaiming interiority for Christianity, because the problem with Catholicism is you could have a great flourishing of external orthodoxy with a cacophony of internal diversity. You know, who knows what the average Catholic believes? And to this day, I'm a Catholic. I have no idea if the person sitting beside me in the pew has a clue what's going on, or maybe they believe entirely different things than me, you know, because we are bound together by an external form. So the Protestant demands an internal coherence. So well and good, because Christianity invents the individual, is the interiorizing moment in the history of the West. But with this emphasis on the internal, this fracturing of the external occurs. And you have the classic Protestant pattern that every new inspiration leads to a new church and complete external cacophony. So they're opposites and they're equally inadequate. That's the point. And they're equally legitimate moments in the revelation. And what we're looking towards, what we're anticipating in this Church of St. John, is a moment where the external is the full and adequate expression of the internal and does not betray it in any way. And yet the internal, which would be fully individual, my interior life fulfilled, would not in any way produce an external cacophony, but an external harmony, you know, the model being the Trinity, right? Each of the three persons of the Trinity are irreplaceable by the others, irreducible, have their own distinct subsistent relational relation to the whole, but none of them has anything that the other doesn't have. And what their individuality amounts to is a perfect unity rather than a cacophony. So the most perfect possible community, which would be a community that is fully united, but not at expense of the diversity of any of its members, where each of the members finds complete and entire individual fulfillment in the collective. That is the Church of John. And for Schelling, it's the image of the kingdom of God on earth. So we should not confuse the Church of St. John with something that Schelling expects to bring about in his lifetime, or with something which he thinks is around the corner. This is his basic critique of Hegel, right? So Hegel had the right idea. That is, he saw Christianity coming to its fruition in a kind of secular moment in which things that were previously held apart become united, and formerly external forms of piety become irrelevant. But he misjudged the time. Schelling writes somewhere, I think it's in The Ages of the World, we must not misjudge our time. And I think in a word, that is his critique of Hegel. Hegel said that this has occurred now in our age, in the 19th century. That there is, and that is why Fukuyama and Kozhev were both correct, that Hegel is declaring the end of history in a certain way, that there is no further revelation expected, no great alteration is expected. Of course, there will be new events and new variations of the notion, but we shouldn't expect something radically disruptive of what we have hitherto learned. So Schelling said, you misjudged the time, Hegel. What you described as the present is still to come. What you reduced or tried to reduce to knowledge can only be prophecy. What you said is necessary could only be a contingency, that is the product of the free act of God. And yet we have the promise, and we can anticipate what is to come as something that renders the current, let's say, the current political regime redundant. So the separation of the church and the state, which is a very good thing and which ought to remain until the third age comes. But when it does come, it will no longer be necessary. So the church will no longer be bounded by the world. It will no longer be in a opposition with the world, the opposition that we read of in the Gospel of John. The world will have become the church. So that is a secular age, you could say. The kingdom of God is a a secular age in the sense that the distinction between the sacred and the secular no longer relevant when everything is sacred, when the sacred has become the secular. So this is, he's not alone on this. I said it's his least original thoughts, not just Joachim of Fiore, Nicholas Berdyaev, and certainly a central strain of Eastern of Russian Orthodox sophiology has speaks of the Church of John. Hansers von Balthasar founded a community of St. John. St. John has been typically read to be the mystical of the evangelists, and he seems to promise an age in which what for most of us has to be learned, you know, through some kind of habit is spontaneous. That's what Schelling means. People will be spontaneously Christian, and they'll be Christian in extremely diverse ways, but they will be fully Christian. He has a sentence at the end of the Auffassung of the Philosophy of Revelation where he says, everyone will have come to this church by his own path and found in it the fulfillment of his own cultural symbolic. That's a rough paraphrase, but what he means is that, you know, the Buddhist will have found the fruition and fulfillment of Buddhism in the kingdom of God on earth. And yet it is Christ's kingdom. So we're going to be surprised. If we're going to be surprised by how much diversity can be included in the divine generosity, we're going to be surprised by how one-sided our version of Christianity really is when we see that it is it was mistaken for the whole. It was mistaken for everything. That's the kind of thought we're playing with. And so the way I've developed this is by calling it religious secularism. It's a way of saying, you know, there might well be something deeply wrong with secularism as we understand it, but we should not miss the Christian roots of the secular impulse. We should not forget that only Christianity secularizes the world. No other tradition does. The essential secularizing moments, let's say the doctrine of the dignity and freedom of the individual, this is found in no other tradition. And I'm quite willing to stand by the controversial claim. This is not to diminish any other tradition, but to actually say that the secular which has been co-opted, of course, because the Antichrist, he's the Antichrist because he looks like the Christ. So we could say the current secular regime is anti-Christian. But that is not to say that secularism, in its essence, lives by a Christian flame. And so we should anticipate, as the world to come, not some kind of apotheosization of the existing church. Wouldn't that be horrible? Who wants it? But rather a stage in which the church as it exists, the visible church, the visible legal structures of the church are no longer necessary, because what they are aiming at is spontaneously arising everywhere. Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, as we come to a close, I think this is a great opportunity to again plug your podcast, because you deal with some of these topics we're getting into, you know, towards the end of our conversation. You're able to get into those much more thoroughly in your podcast, which is for our listeners is called The Secular Christ. So I would definitely encourage anyone who's interested in these things to go check that out. As we come to a close, I always like to give our guests a chance to share what they have in the works, anything coming down the pipeline that you're working on, or anything else you'd like to plug here.
Right. See, I got myself really tangled up in environmental work for a decade, and I ended up piling up manuscripts in my computer. So I have 3 books that are in preparation, and they've been in preparation for a long time, and I've been commanded not to dream up other books until I finish them and produce them, although I keep dreaming up other things. My current dream is to write a book called How to Be a Conservative Environmentalist, but I'm not allowed to think about that. So what's on the go now is a book that you know about, which is called The Soul of Nature, Essays in Depth Psychology, wherein I pick up some of my work in psychoanalysis and some of the things that weren't published, some of the things that were published, and organize them with a more explicit framing, theological framing. They were always theologically oriented. Everything I ever did in psychoanalysis had a theological frame, but I want to make that more explicit. So that's immediately on the agenda. There's also a book that's been so long in the making, I don't even want to tell you how old it is, but it's something like my confessions. Okay. And the third is the second part of the late Schelling book. So the turn to the positive, the philosophical, the philosophy of the late Schelling, which came out in 2020, was announced as part one of two, because I took the second part out. I had a much longer book. And the part two is all Trinity and Christology of the late Schelling. And that is also more or less drafted in manuscript form. That also has to come out. So I'm going to be busy for the next couple of years with these things. And then hopefully I'll be free to do something new.
Well, I know at Wittfenstock we're really excited about the Soul of Nature book you mentioned, which, you know, obviously is contracted with Cascade and going to be publishing under Veritas. So we're very excited to be working with you on that and excited to see it come out. Our last question is just where can our listeners find you for those who are interested in your work?
Well, I'm easily found, like everyone else in our age. So Memorial University website is a good place to go. I keep my academia.edu site pretty operative. I have a Facebook page, which I check dutifully once a year. So probably best to go to the university site and fire me a note that way.
Great. Thank you so much, Professor McGraw. Thank you for taking the time. I know it's a late Friday evening for you, so I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Zach. I enjoyed the conversation quite a bit. Thanks so much.